Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Americans love their pets and love to talk about their adorable personalities. However, many will also say they don't want to go too far psychoanalyzing their animals because we've all been told it's bad to anthropomorphize. But our guest today says, forget it, because new science indicates animals absolutely have personalities and emotions and even inner lives. We're talking this hour with longtime wildlife biologist John Shivick about his new book, Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. In it, Shivick says the evidence now is too great to be ignored, with research showing unique character traits among not just beloved species like horses, cats, or dogs, but also crabs, lizards, even spiders. John Shivick joins us from Utah Public Radio at Utah State University in Logan, and let's hear from you on this topic. Your comments, observations, questions are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And John Shivick, welcome to The Exchange. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Well, among animal lovers, John, there's no question about this. But among scientists like yourself, how controversial an idea is this, that animals have a distinct personality, even emotions, even inner lives?
Well, luckily, it's becoming less controversial. But certainly during my training, through my undergraduate education and graduate education, it was anathema. It was one of the things you don't do. You don't anthropomorphize. You don't attribute or ascribe anything that's human-like into animals. So that was an issue for quite a while, but it's only now that we're starting to realize, wait a minute, these things have the same physiology. They've got neurons like we do. It's not a leap to ascribe some of the, we can't know exactly what a turtle feels or a tortoise feels, but we do know they have similar neurons, so we know that they probably do feel. So we've come a long way.
Why was that so taboo?
That's a great question, because what's really interesting about this is that back in Darwin's time, Darwin even realized this. He noticed similar musculature. He noticed that certain animals would cringe or react in certain ways, and he was fine with saying, "Wow, we all evolved the same way. That means that these animals probably had these same emotions and things." But then we have to put ourselves in the context of Victorian England, and so some of the ideas like evolution caught hold, but these ideas of animal emotion and personality, they didn't. And what actually happened was a backlash. C. Lloyd Morgan, a scientist at the time, very influential in behavior, he said, no, you cannot. We have to do the Occam's razor sort of thing, and you cannot ascribe anything about how humans feel to animals. You can only record what you can observe, what you can measure from the outside. And so he just kind of cut us off at the knees. You can't infer anything. You can only write things down that you measure.
So if you're going to be a scientist, you can't infer, you can't suggest, you can't guess. You have to be strictly measuring, observational. But you mentioned something there, Occam's razor. So you need to tell us what that is.
Oh, okay. So that's the idea that, in the simplest form, the simplest explanation is the best. So So that's what they were getting at, is if you could say that an animal did something because something good happened beforehand. So a dog wags its tail because it got a treat. You could say, well, treats cause tail wagging. And Morgan would say, you don't want to infer, well, the dog got a treat, so the dog was happy, so the dog wagged its tail. But the unfortunate thing is that inference about dog being happy or sad or whatever is actually a useful thing. And in a lot of ways, it is a simpler explanation than just saying there's a direct connection between a tongue and a tail.
Well, I'm interested in what you said about Darwin, because as you just mentioned, you know, people latched onto his theories of evolution, and people still talk about him today and all his amazing insights. But we don't know. I didn't know until I read this book that Darwin did talk about animal personality. Yeah. So give us a little more, because it's really interesting, John, on why people adopted his theories on evolution but didn't adopt his theories on animal personality. Why was that so scary?
Oh, I'm not sure, but I think it's a matter of degree. The evidence of evolution was a little easier to describe or to show. People have bred animals for a long time. You can see it, selection in our own lifetimes in a lot of ways, and I think we followed it. But the resistance to evolution is the same resistance to animal personality, and that is humans really like to set themselves off as being different. There's something fundamental about human nature, I think, that we like to say, first when I was growing up, oh, animals don't use tools, only humans use tools. Then we saw evidence of, chimpanzees, maybe dolphins, maybe New Caledonian crows, And then as the more we look, we saw that, humans aren't that different that way. And even right-handedness and left-handedness, animals will do that. So we just kind of are chinking away at this desire for separation between humans and animals. Now we've come to the point where I think the last question is, personality and emotion, do animals have those too? Well, probably.
How does scientists sort out the difference between animal personality or behavior or instinct or a learned desire to, please the one who brings you the food, but that's it? I mean, how do you make sense of those different terms, John?
Exactly. Well, that's an excellent question, and I think that's exactly where the science is right now on this. So we've come a long way to the point of saying, animal personality, individual variation, emotion, all these things will exist in animals. And now it's really the hard questions are going to start coming out. An animal, we can measure through time. So, one interesting story, and useful one, was pre-Hurricane Katrina and post-Hurricane Katrina with some aquarium dolphins. And the researchers had measured the personalities or the variation of these dolphins before the storm. And then the storm came in, they got washed out to sea, big traumatic event, and they measured them again after the storm. And almost all the dolphins, it was interesting, the measures that they used were the same before and after the storm. So what they showed then was that, yes, that animals do have personalities that's consistent within the animals, that's different than just, say, a mood or that they're all the same in stimulus response. But then the final thing, the other thing that they had to look at, was there was one dolphin that was traumatized, that their personality changed before and after this traumatic event, which could be interpreted as post-traumatic stress. So all of those things are things we're identifying now in animals, and we have to be careful and really cognizant of the fact that it's easy to confuse something like something being a really good, easygoing animal versus it was in a really good mood that day or a bad mood that day or something. So that's a great question, and I think the science is just starting to tackle that, and that's what's so exciting about this field.
Well, what were those scientists in the dolphin case that you mentioned? And you're right, it's a dramatic story. They got washed out to sea during that terrible flood and hurricane. What were they measuring? Because I wonder, how do you even measure personality in an animal or a person for that matter?
Right. So there's lots of different ways to measure personality. And in humans, we typically rely on some of these Myers-Briggs type tests where someone will fill out a survey and then we can score the survey. And then we have to usually, with humans, we even when we can talk to humans, we still have to correct it, because people will usually lie and portray themselves cognizantly or, you know, subtly in their own, in the best light they can. So we still even have to, even with humans, when we can directly ask them, we still have to correct and deal with it. Animals more difficult, because you can't get a dolphin or a wolf or whatever to fill out a survey. But we can observe them, and we can observe them in different situations. We can observe them in, we put an animal into a novel environment and see how quickly they investigate it, or you pop up something that's new and scary and see how long they're afraid of it. And we can measure these things, such as bold or shy. We can measure them if you put food in there, we can see how aggressive they are to food, or you can put them with other animals and see how aggressive they are with other animals. It's it's a lot like humans in a staff meeting. You know, if people will come in and they'll some of the dominant ones, and they exert their authority immediately. Other ones are sort of the meek ones, and you can see that just watching them. So it's a
how social they are and how aggressive they are. They probably give you more honest answers, maybe in a way, right? They're not trying to.
We're better watching than filling out forms.
Right. So how do you define anthropomorphizing?
Okay. So that's this idea of simply is ascribing human, anything that's human to an animal, to a non-human animal. And we generally mean things like moods or emotions or even personality. That's it, simply. It's just ascribing human characteristics to animals.
And is it bad?
Well, that's what we thought it was, because it, and it can be. Okay, here's the thing, too. So I don't want to give the notion of we can just throw out all sense of objectivity and walk in and say, you know, my cat's meowing. Oh, therefore, he thinks this and this and this and feels this and this and this. There's a certain amount of, we have to restrain ourselves. I can't say my cat has the same physiology as me. My cat probably, you know, feels hungry or happy or whatever it is. But we have to really be really careful and limit ourselves and use the inference to help us understand, but not use the inference to say we know exactly what's going on in that animal. So anthropomorphism, to an extreme, I think it would be bad, but I don't think we should throw out all of the, you know, anthropomorphic baby with the bathwater.
Yeah, and you were saying that's what we have done for a long, long time, and now new science, and we'll definitely get into all the examples in the book about how, you know, real science is showing us that animals do indeed have personalities. Today in The Exchange, John Shivick is with us, a longtime wildlife biologist. His new book is called Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. Let's hear from you. Your observations, questions are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. What have you noticed about animal personality? What do you think crosses the line between genuine animal characteristics and some anthropomorphizing? 1-800-892-6477 again is our number. So the big question, John, why does this matter beyond, you know, reading this book and going, oh, that's so cool about crabs and spiders and coyotes? But beyond that, it's interesting and cool to know about. Why is it important?
Oh, thanks for asking that. It's important for a number of reasons. I guess at its face value, it's sort of in some ways a no-brainer, something that people would often say, oh, gosh, I know my dog has a personality. I know this dog's different than another dog, and it's there's no new there. The new part is expanding out first to all sorts of wild animals, to wildlife, to really surprising places, spiders, water striders, crabs, like you said, you know, not just dolphins and apes and the usual subjects. It's important for science in that this individual variation, how these animals develop and choose and live their lives, that's something that's heritable and acted upon. That's how animals evolve. If there wasn't that variation, there would be no evolution. And behavior's a shortcut in a lot of ways. You can't go and a dolphin can't, or it'd take millions and millions of years for a dolphin to evolve a spongy, soft thing on their nose. But by having an investigative, smart, whatever personality, if a dolphin figures out, hey, I can use a sponge to probe in the coral to scare the fish out to eat, that thing, through behavior, has leaped forward millions of years in what would have taken for physiological adaptation. So there's the science of it. It's going to be important for how we understand the world. It's not just physiology that's running ecology. It's behavior. It's how bluebirds, for instance, great stories about bluebirds and aggressive bluebirds and more passive bluebirds, and some do better in some conditions and some do better in other conditions. And it allows species to expand to places they couldn't otherwise live. So there's many reasons. There's social reasons. There's personal reasons that for me have helped me understand, oh, wow, they're supposed to be very, this is why there's bad people because there's and bad animals, because it's a natural thing to have variation. And you're going to have the bell curve of variation of different personalities, to wonderful and sweet to aggressive psychopaths. And this is something that helps to explain the world around us.
So it's a shout out in a way for species diversity. If all spiders had the exact same personality, then when natural conditions changed, those spiders might be wiped out.
Exactly. I know, isn't that interesting? It's nature is, it was hard. Gosh, I've worked for government for a bunch of years and things, and I've had all my sensitivity training and all the things about diversity and how diversity is good, and always sort of felt kind of squishy and emotional to me. But this, when I've studied this and realized, oh, nature wants diversity, and the reason nature wants diversity is so you can change, you can adapt. And it's the same thing with a human work environment and, God, say, a country or anything. That diversity, as hard as it is, because the more diverse you are, the more conflicts you have between individuals, but the more diverse you are, the more new ideas, new ways to adapt to changing situations you have. So nature demands diversity, and we should learn a little bit learn from that.
Well, we've done a bunch of programs here in the Exchange on trees, because we're the second most heavily forested state in the country. And one of the themes that keeps coming up, John, in our programs on trees is that those trees that are not diverse or that don't have a resistance or that monocultures, you know, sometimes those species die out because they get hit hard by one blight and boom, they're gone.
That's exactly right. And so what the difference here is that we're not just talking about the physiology of of a tree or of an animal or something. It overlaps into behavior of those animals. That same variation that we can measure in tail length or in weight or whatever, it's just as important in how animals manifest their behavior in variable ways.
Here's an email from Ruth that just came in Canterbury. She says, I wanted to comment on what I've learned by raising chickens. They definitely have individual personalities. I never would have imagined that without raising them myself. Ruth says, some are bullies, the pecking order. Some are aloof. Others are what we call people chickens. One such friendly bird follows me around the yard, will jump on my arm or shoulder. She's more curious and experimental than others in the flock. We noticed that she was different from the others in her hatch batch from her first days. We've tried to raise them all the same with plenty of attention and good care, but there's something inside each of them that is different. Wow, Ruth, thank you so much. You've got chickens too, John. What do you think?
I do, and I'd agree with her completely. So chickens are they're amazing that way. And the other thing that's really, I mean, they're basically feathered reptiles, right? These things are the kind of what the remnants of dinosaurs walking around the earth. And if it's that apparent to us that chickens, even from hatchlings, react and have that amount of behavioral variation, there's a big hint that, boy, this goes further than dogs and apes.
Well, coming up after a short break, John, I want to ask you a little bit more about your chickens, including bold Wesley the chicken and shy Priscilla the chicken, because this story illustrates how you need to be careful in terms of assigning certain personality characteristics. So we'll talk about that after a short break. Ruth, thank you for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More with John Shivick on his new book, Mousy Cats, Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. Stay with us.
Okay.
Opinion by Hydro-Québec.
Be honest with you, I don't know what hydropower is.
New England stands on the threshold of a decision, whether or not to hook up to Canadian hydropower. But that power comes with a lot of history.
If you dismantle Hydro-Québec, it would be like dismantling us.
Hydropower, the French-Canadian identity, and New England's carbon problem. Get the latest Outside In wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the science of animal personalities. That's the subtitle of a new book by our guest, wildlife biologist John Shivick. He joins us from Utah Public Radio at Utah State University in Logan. And you can join us, too. We'd love to hear from you, your observations, questions, comments about animal personalities and what the science tells us. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, John, let's talk about the chickens. Just before the break, I read an email from Ruth who talked about the differences she sees in her flock. You've got some chickens. Phyllis, you say, is shy. Wesley, you say, is bold. Why do you call Wesley bold?
Oh, chickens, always a favorite subject, right? So Wesley was the one that would walk. I could be in my house, and this is an animal that would wander off from the coop, wander through the yard, and not just restrain herself to digging around in the yard and garden, et cetera, but she'd come up on the deck, and I'd look around, and she'd start to walk into the house. So, but then the rest of the chickens, the rest of them, a lot less social. They just kept among themselves. They'd stay away. So it's just like the email said before, Ruth, right, that some right from the get-go are way more social and interested in you and other things that are going on and really just sort of inquisitive, if I can use that term. But you'd mentioned something, too. There's some Phyllis, another chicken in the same flock, was quite the opposite in a lot of ways. And this is something we talked a little bit about, anthropomorphism and how it can be dangerous.
Right, yeah. And, go ahead.
And I used for Phyllis how to describe her. Phyllis was the one that would sit quietly. Oh, she was hilarious, this Polish chicken with big feathers and all this kind of thing. But she would sit quietly, and she had her spot she liked to sit at. And even if it rained or snowed, it would drip on her, and you'd have to kind of shoo her in. And in a lot of ways, people could say, oh, she's dumb, or she's stupid, or she's lazy, or whatever. We could attribute weird characteristics through anthropomorphism that may or may not have been accurate. She could actually, and I think I argue in the book, or mentioned, she could have just been zen. You know, could have been
just, she's meditating.
She's meditating. She has things figured out. So it's important to allow us to interpret, but it's also important not to overinterpret, and especially in a judgy way. We still got to try to be objective about our observations.
Well, and you even use yourself kind of as an example in that chicken story. You know, you're on a business trip, you're in San Diego, you're missing your family back home, you go out for a drink, you decide, you know, I don't want to socialize with my colleagues. I just kind of want to sit here and be a little bit moody and stare at the sunset. So are you shy or are you just feeling quiet? Are you zen or are you feeling lonely? So go ahead, John. You use yourself as an example there.
Well yes. And that's it. And that's what we have to separate a given day with how we are in general and also the context. So if I were at home and if I was in a familiar place, I would act very differently than if I'm all halfway across the country and alone. So we have to try to account for we have to kind of control for all those different variables that are going on around an animal. If an animal's in a novel environment, it's going to react one way. If it's in a familiar environment with a novel thing, it's going to react a different way. And the point there is that I'm an animal just like any other one. And these are the types of things that we have to try to answer.
Well, bravery or boldness is an important concept in this book. Among chickens, crabs, coyotes, other animals. Why is this a personality trait that scientists keep returning to, John?
Well, this bravery and boldness thing, I can use an example of even bluebirds. It actually controls how animals can adapt within any ecological system. Okay, here's an example with the bluebirds. So there's some males that are really aggressive, and they fight a lot. They control really big territories. They control all the nest holes. So they seem like they're the studly fighting macho males, right? So if we think about that, and sometimes in some human terms, is that, oh, well, that must be these big desirable mates. They must be really successful and do quite well. And actually, they do, especially in new populations. So as western bluebirds move across the country and inhabit new places where mountain bluebirds are, these aggressive males kick out all the others, and they establish this beachhead. They allow that species to move to other places in the country they wouldn't be able to move. But here's the tricky thing: as that population ages, those animals are always fighting amongst themselves. So when it comes time to feed their mate on the nest, they don't have time for that because they're all fighting and doing other things. But then there's other types of males that are the meek and timid ones that aren't as aggressive, and they have smaller territories, not as many nest holes. But when it comes time to feeding the mate, they're very caring. They're better hunters. They're better providers. So every female has a choice between the macho male that has a lot of territory or this good provider that's maybe not as, not as macho as the other ones. And it shows how important ecologically having these different personality types is.
So those milder male bluebirds also play an important role in maintaining this species and making sure it doesn't die out.
Exactly, yeah. As it turns out, the macho males don't, they're not as successful reproductively in the long run as the less bellicose ones are.
Super interesting. And in a minute, I want to ask you about brave crabs versus shy crabs. Having grown up on the coast, I thought this was also really interesting. But let's go back to our listeners, John. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And to Lori in Bow. Hi, Lori. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to tell a cute story about a cat. I've been a cat lady for well over 50 years and never had this happen before. A year ago, my daughter's friend brought me a cat, young cat, which she had rescued from a shelter that was about to put her down for non-adoption. And I had another cat at home, which was found in a laundry room several years ago, and I adopted. Anyhow, this cutie pie is all over the place, running around at half speed in a small apartment, and looking for things to do. I don't know how to entertain her, but she ate a cable on my blood pressure machine.
Oh, my goodness, that's not good.
And she tears things pom-pom. She tore a pom-pom off some kind of cat toy. And that's the game we play with this purple pom-pom.
So what's the message on animal personality for you, Lori, from this?
I never played hide-and-seek with a cat.
I see. So kind of like a dog, you know. And sometimes people say, John, cats are no fun. With dogs, you can play fetch and frisbee and all kinds of games. I actually have a cat who plays fetch, too, Lori. I wanted to let you know that. One who is completely uninterested and one who will play fetch with you. What do you think about this call, that there's a cat with a sort of dog-like personality?
Right. I think cats are a real gateway for people to learn about cats and chickens, too, right, to learn about differing animal personalities. And, no, I've got the same stories, too. I've got I talk a lot about them. I tease my cat quite a bit in the book about
Penguino.
Penguino is somewhat obnoxious and has a completely overbearing and annoying personality, but it's because of that strength of personality that I've bonded with the guy. And yeah, I think the question back is too is like, well, we see that these different animals have different ways of going through life, whether they play fetch and they're inquisitive or whatever. Now the next question is, and this is the fascinating aspect of the science, why is it? Why is one cat that way where they'll play fetch, they'll chew the cables on machines, and other ones don't? And I think we can translate it back to like the bluebird story. Some are aggressive, and they're going to do better by being aggressive, being loud, doing these things, and other ones are having a different strategy. And in the natural world, and indeed the human world, being one way or the other is going to get you adopted or get you to survive. So that's the question that we're running to here. So not only do they have them and have these great stories, why are these stories? Why do these personalities exist?
And why it matters. And again, it gets back to the point that you keep making, John, you know, that if there isn't diversity within a species, that species is more vulnerable.
Gone, yes.
So you need the, you know, sort of the quiet, shy cat that likes to sit on your lap and purr all day. And you need a cat like Lori's that runs around and chews things.
Exactly.
Lori, thank you so much for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. One of my favorite examples from the book, John, as fun as it is to read about your cat, and it's laugh out loud funny, so, was brave crabs versus shy crabs. And you write that it shows what our mothers taught us, that it's your personality, not your looks, that determine your success in attracting a mate. So tell us about the brave crabs and the shy crabs.
Yes, the crab story is an awkward one to talk about in some ways, because it does show some bias for how we've been measuring things in the past. And what these crabs are walking across the coast in Australia, and they have their little dens and holes that they set up that they can run to and if there's a predator that comes through. And the researchers set up some really cool experiments where they made artificial birds flying over so they can test the different responses of different crabs. And so they can measure this bold personality. You can see if one crab is more bold and relative to predators than other ones. And they measured all of that, those characteristics. But what we typically would have done, because these crabs have these big claws, so these males, when they attract a mate, they'll stay outside their den and they'll wave these big claws around as if that this big, look, I've got this big claw and I'm sexy, and, you know, attract their mate into the den that way. But when the researchers measured the claws and the way they waved the claws, that wasn't the thing. That wasn't the thing that correlated with what was attractive to the males. That's what we see as humans. We're going to say, we always tell those stories. And there's dangers in only looking at physiology. We tell ourselves a story. They have a big claw because it attracts mates. But as it turns out, it was actually how brave or shy the different crabs were that attracted the mates into the dens. So there's something obvious physiologically, but we've got to be subtle. We've got to acknowledge personality, measure personality, and then we notice, wow, that is a huge effect on how successful an animal is in reproducing.
Well, and I love that story, too, because it shows us that it isn't just cats and horses and dogs and chimps that have personality. You know, those are pretty easy to see. But crabs, for goodness sake. You also write about insects and arachnids. You know, to many of us, myself included, a bug is a bug is a bug. Although we might recognize differences between, you know, a spider and a ladybug. Tell us, though, you know, wrong again, what did you learn from looking at studies, John, on a type of spider called a fishing spider?
Yeah, that's another fun one. So scientists tend to We spend a lot of time looking at these species where the females often eat the males. Oh, boy, I thought my courtship was difficult. But
you thought dating was rough, right?
Yeah, I thought dating's rough, but at least we don't walk into a bar and think, you know, we might get eaten or killed. And eaten. So as hard as it is for a male these days, it's not that bad, right? But that's the way it works for these fishing spiders. So the males have to cautiously find their mates and attract the mate and be able to calm her down enough to jump in, copulate, and jump away, essentially. It's not very romantic at all. And then what happens in the fishing spiders, you've got different female spiders that are large, and the way they get large is by being really aggressive and really aggressive hunters, and then they become large, and if they're large, they'll have lots of eggs, right? And then the ones that aren't as aggressive won't have as many eggs. So you would think, wow, gosh, you're going to want to mate with an large, aggressive female because they'll have more babies, right? Unfortunately, a large, aggressive female is, well, a large, aggressive female. And the males that will try to mate with them are more likely to be eaten and instead of having a successful mating. So there's different strategies there, too. So we have to pay attention to how large, how aggressive, and that interplay in courtship, even between male and female spiders. So if it's that important for spiders, gosh, it's important for everything.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, at first when I read that story, I was focusing on the personality of the female spiders. But then you start to wonder, why do the male spiders choose either the large aggressive female or the milder, smaller female? Is it just random, or are they, hate to use this word, but thinking about that choice?
Yeah, and that's a great question. Yeah, I mean, that's the point. Isn't that exciting? What I found out about this research is that we're just at the tip of the iceberg here. So we're really starting to get into the really cool questions now, just like the ones you're coming up with.
Well, in all of this so far, John, has been observational. Are there any personality genes that you can actually, you know, measure in the blood, whatever, in animals? I mean, can you find an aggression gene or a caretaking gene or a seek new territory gene?
Yeah, and that's the other thing that we're looking at. So we do know that these different behaviors are heritable, and there are some genes that are being attributed to how likely an animal is to disperse or that kind of thing. And sometimes the genes, it's straightforward, it goes through. But then you find other populations where there's animals that act a certain way, but they don't have that gene. So we're still just delving into it a little bit. We do know it's heritable. I mean, the best example, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard about the Russian fox experiment that's been going on, oh gosh, for decades, and where they took foxes, the researcher would walk by the cage, and if it was a fox that looked at them or interacted with them in any way, that fox would be bred, and the ones that were shy, they would avoid. And within just several generations, the foxes now they're like little puppies. They're cute. They're adorable. They want to interact with people. And it's a heritable trait. So, yeah, so we don't have all the genes figured out any more than we have them figured out for anything from, you know, blue eyes to cancer to whatever. But we do know that it's a heritable trait, which means natural selection acts on it, which means it is important for evolution.
So Russians are breeding foxes to be house dogs, basically.
Kind of, yeah. They're still foxes, so they're still terrible pets. I mean, they'll still, tear up stuff and pee on things and be foxes. But the difference is they're social and interact with people, which a typical fox wouldn't do.
Well, you do write, though, that, and maybe this is because it takes place over generations, as you said, but there's an example in the book of a couple that loved their, I think it was an ox, right? Named Chance.
Oh,
is that right?
Oh.
And so they loved this animal. And when it died, they tried to recreate it with its offspring, and it didn't work. So why not? You talked about the foxes and how it's slowly working, but with this ox, it did not work at all. The son was not anything like the father.
And here's the thing about this heritability and personality. This is another tricky thing about personality. There are genetic components, but there are also environmental components. It's the nature versus nurture argument. And as with everything else, it's a little bit of both. So if we can, and people do this now more and more frequently, you can clone your pets. You can clone a beloved pet. But it's not, well, it doesn't have to be Pet Cemetery, but it's not going to come back as exactly the same animal that was before. Conditions in utero change. Conditions when they're a puppy change. Conditions as they grow older change. So there might be some very similar characteristics, but it won't be the exact same animal, even if it's a clone, any way that two identical twins are not the same same person.
We will talk more in just a moment, and you can join us. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More in just a moment with John Shivick and his book, Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the science of personalities. Now, while most dog or cat lovers will eagerly describe their pets' adorable characteristics, The author of a new book says it's not just Fido and Fluffy, that reptiles, fish, crabs, insects all have unique personalities and behaviors. We're finding out more. The book is called Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes. The author is John Shivick, and you can join us too with your questions, comments, observations, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And John, here's an email that came in from Tony, who says, I had the good fortune to film Kanzi, the bonobo who communicates with lexigrams, decades ago, and the experience enlarged my life. Kanzi behaved just like a young child, demonstrated preferences for members of our crew, showed tenderness. He worried about the holes in my ears for earrings and snuggled up in blankets with me watching Planet of the Apes. After nearly a week in his presence, Tony says, I felt as though I'd spent time with a distant cousin in a foreign country. We couldn't speak the same language, but we communicated feelings and interests with acuity. Tony says it was a wonderful experience and has given me the chance to consider all non-human animals in a different light. Wow, Tony, thank you so much for the email. And John, you write about bonobos and other primates in the book. So go ahead. They are especially fascinating for us to study because they're such close cousins.
Right. So that's a natural leaping off point when we've got simians, other animals that are very related to us. We have similar facial structures, similar body types, and so it's in a lot of ways easier for us to read their language and to understand their language than it is for us to understand maybe a dog or a cat or something sometimes, and certainly a spider or a crab. But, you know, something else that's really interesting that came up there, and this is something we get towards in the book, too, in terms of the significance of these animal personalities. And what Tony said was fascinating in that she saw preferences for different people in the crew by this bonobo. And this is something we get at, too. So having personalities, having certain temperaments, means that we've got this ability to bond with other people of similar or complementary temperaments, whatever that is. It'd be nice to figure out what love is one day. But we've got this ability to bond with other people and with other animals. For whatever reason, I've had lots of cats, right? I've had lots of dogs. But there tends to be one super special dog that stood out from all the others, one super special cat that stood out from all the others, special chicken that stood out from all the others. And this idea of personality and uniqueness leads us to the next step, which is these unique bonds between humans and humans and humans and animals. And that's an excellent example of that thing occurring.
Let's take another call. This is Ron in Manchester. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling in today. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. So all of these things apply to people as well. And you talked about how different personality traits are heritable. So, you know, conceivably, a lot of human personality traits are also heritable. If that's the case, to what extent are we responsible for our own actions? And to what extent are our behaviors a result of our genes, like things like aggression, for instance? You know, it kind of puts that in a whole different light when you think about, you know, people committing crimes and things like that. Are we going to get to a point where someone will be able to be in court and say, hey, I've got genetic markers A, B, and C. I was destined to commit this violent crime.
Yeah, so don't blame me. That's a really interesting point, Ron, and I appreciate the call. And it highlights for me, John, how important this research is on animal personality as well. But go ahead. I wonder what your thoughts are.
No, that's a great observation, and it's right up with the kinds of things we need to start talking about. And I think with humans, I mean, there's a difference between having an excuse saying I'm an aggressive person and choosing. We still have the ability to choose. We're not completely programmed. And I was looking at the other way around in terms more of therapies and things. If we can identify what makes a person a psychopath, then maybe we can treat the psychopathy better. So there's ways that it's going to be important to understand this in animals and then understand this in people and use this to benefit everybody overall. And it's not just simple genes either. I mean, it's genes plus environment. And it's not only the criminal thing. Let's think of something like PTSD. We can send a lot of people over through really traumatic events. And some of them will come back. Many of them will come back fine. Many children that grow up in horrid situations will grow up okay. But then some will be completely traumatized and completely susceptible to all of those problems. If we understand that better in humans and in animals, it'll lead to a better earth in a lot of ways.
Well, thank you for the call, Ron. And here's another one, Ben in Manchester. Go ahead, Ben. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Thank you, Laura. I mean, I listen to you every day, and thank you.
Go ahead, Ben. Are you still with us? I think we're losing Ben on his phone. Ben, I'm sorry about that. I hope you call back. The number again is 1-800-892-6477. Let's try Patty in Westminster. Go ahead, Patty. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
A little nervous. I love listening to you two talk because I love animals. I just wanted to tell you real quick about a chicken that was hanging around my mother's house. They named her Hilda. She had the greatest personality. And when I would go up and visit, she'd come running to see me. And honestly, every time I looked at her, for some reason, I pictured her as a little old lady out there hanging around, very social. I always pictured her as Barbara Bush. I don't know, carrying a pocketbook, you know, in a nice way. But every time I would call my mother, Hilda would get excited when she'd hear that phone ring, and she'd jump on her lap, and she'd make all these little sounds into the phone. She always knew it was me.
Well, here's the question then. You know, when you mentioned the chicken getting excited, was she excited because of you, Patty, or because you symbolized food, or what?
No, she loved sitting on everybody's lap. Even when my mother was holding her little dog, she would sit there. Oh, she was so sociable. When I would go to visit my mother, she'd come out and talk and follow us around. She had to be right there. She had to come into the house. My mother didn't really want that, but and whenever I would get ready to leave, if I didn't see her, I would yell, "Hilda, I'm leaving now," and she would come out and go make those funny little hen noises.
Oh my gosh!
I really wanted to bring her home.
Well, Patty, it's a great call. Thank you so much. And you know, John, it's interesting. I thought when we opened the show today that we get a lot of people calling about cats and dogs, but we got an email from Ruth about a chicken. We've got a caller, Patty, about a chicken. You talked about the personalities of the chickens that you have. And we did a show a couple years ago about the growing popularity of raising chickens, some people keeping chickens in their house. I mean, when I was growing up, we thought chickens were, you know, dumb and food. So why the shift there?
Well, I know this has been very pleasing to me. This book's kind of, it struck a nerve a little bit of, I think we're finally just sort of opening our eyes and accepting, we've come a long way to say, they're animals. They're even their chickens, and they have personalities. So, okay, yeah, all right, that's fait accompli. We know that. Now let's start studying it. Let's start looking at why different chickens have different personalities and why, you know, into people and how that's going to play out ecologically, socially, and evolutionarily. That's now it's really rewarding to hear these stories, actually.
All right. Well, thank you for that one. And Alana is in Plastow. Hi, Alana. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm so excited to hear this program. I listen to NHPR with my sister. I work at New England Reptile Distributors in Plaster, New Hampshire, and I work with a lot of really big reptiles. And I'm excited to see that the public is starting to kind of get a grasp of the fact that animals have different personalities. But I wanted to talk about reptiles in particular because reptiles don't exhibit emotions the way, like, even a chicken would. Like, we can look at a chicken and you can see whether or not it's happy, but they're very different. So people think of them as cold and unfeeling. But I have relationships with a lot of reptiles, and they can tell the difference between different people. And they show their emotion very, very differently. So basically, I was just calling to say that I'm really excited to see that there are other people out there that are interested in learning about the personalities of animals that aren't considered common, you know?
Well, that's really interesting. So you work with New England Reptile Distributors. So day to day, you're working with this, Alana.
Yeah.
How do they exhibit personality or emotion, in your opinion?
Okay, so like monitor lizards, they get really, really big, and they can be pretty aggressive. But we breed animals here for, like, you know, basically like pets. Like, we have big, big monitor lizards that typically people would only be able to get from a wild caught source, but we breed them in captivity. So we have monitor lizards that are 4 and 5 generations bred into captivity at this point. And we're starting to see, just like those Russian foxes, we're starting to see personality traits show up. And the more domestic they get, the more we're seeing these personality traits show up. So a monitor lizard, for example, you watch its eyes and the way they pin. They remind me a lot of birds, actually, because I worked with birds before I did large reptiles. And when their eyes pin, you can kind of read their emotion based on, you know, what they're doing and their body language and things like that.
What does that mean, their eyes pin, Alana?
Yeah, so, like, their pupils dilate. Like African gray parrots have really, really light eyes. So if you watch an African gray, you can see a lot of their personality showing through their eyes. And if their eyes pin very rapidly, it can mean, you know, maybe they're excited about food that you're about to give them. Maybe they're excited about cuddles you're about to give them. Sometimes based on the way their feathers are laying, it can mean that they're going to bite you. But monitors are kind of the same way. They just don't have feathers to express. So they're a little bit harder to read for some people. But it's a similar interaction because, as we were talking about earlier, reptiles and birds are very similar.
Well, and so, Alana, I'm so glad you called. This is really interesting. And true confessions, I'm a cat person, okay? I have two. And over the years, my kids have at various points in time said, can we get a lizard or an iguana or something? And I've always said, no way. So make the case that these have cute personalities, interesting personalities,
personalities
that I would want to hang out with.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And there's tons of different options. I mean, a monitor lizard is not for everyone in the same way that a Great Dane isn't for everyone. So if you're looking for something cute, get a crested gecko or a leopard gecko or something like that. Ball pythons are amazing snake pets. And, you know, the biggest problem I think people have with reptiles is they tend to eat whole prey items, in which case we're talking about, you know, rodents and fuzzy things that a lot of people consider to be cute. But you know, everything has to eat. Your dog is eating kibble that was originally something that isn't cute and fuzzy. But they do. They make amazing, amazing pets. So, yeah, and if anyone is interested in seeing these guys firsthand, like I said, we're right in Plaston, New Hampshire, and we have tons of really cool stuff to see. We hold public tours. So if anyone wants firsthand experience with some of these amazing animals, tours every Saturday and Sunday at 4 o'clock at New England Reptile Distributors.
Alana, thank you so much. Real interesting.
No problem. Yeah,
all right,
thank
bye-bye.
You.
Wow. What do you think, John? I know you looked at salamanders in this book, but lizard, reptile personalities.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that call. And we did, and I've got some discussion about lizards and lizard social structure and how different lizards pair and bond with each other and form friend groups in all these social environments. It happens to them. So I think the biggest point that was made there was that it's just a matter of paying attention, right? So if we just immediately, it's just a snake, it's going to be just like every other snake, stimulus response, and that's what we're going to believe. But if we allow ourselves, and I think that's my major point here, if we allow ourselves to look and pay attention, we're going to start seeing how important differences are between individual animals. And this is snakes. This is everything. Oh, gosh, one of my favorite books lately is Cy Montgomery's Soul of the Octopus. And she's just talking about different octopuses up there and how different their personalities are. It's fascinating stuff. It's just a matter of paying attention.
Well, you know, we talked earlier about anthropomorphizing and how when you were being raised as a wildlife biologist, you know, we're absolutely told, no, 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 don't do that. Is there an opposite to anthropomorphizing where we look too much at animal personality and we immediately say, yes, yes, that's just like us? You know, we draw too many similarities.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what I'm saying. That's what I really want to caution on. And this is fun, and these anecdotes are fun. But at some point, at least from the science perspective of it, and that's really what I'm focusing on as much as I can, we do need to move into still categorizing and identifying things that we can measure in a somewhat objective way. We need to infer, but we can't infer too far. We can't go and say this cat is this way because of this, and because it can lead to the wrong conclusions too. I could think that my cat loves me, or it could just be my cat just is hungry. You know, we've got to be careful and do it scientifically and objectively, and ask the questions and investigate them over time.
Well, and like Ron said, you know, if we're going to talk about animal genes and how there are aggressive spiders and less aggressive spiders. You know, Ron asked a really important question. Do we extend that to humans and say, well, I'm just aggressive and, you know, forgive me for this crime? And, you know, you said no, but there is a point where you could take this too far. It sounds like you're cautioning against that.
Yeah, that's exactly it, yes. Well, the point is to learn, right? Not to look for excuses, and to learn and to understand, and to do it in as objective way as we can, but also in a way that allows us. We don't want to shut the doors completely on, like we had, and just say, well, if there's no animal personality, animals are different than humans, et cetera, and not pursue that line of reasoning. Now we're at a point where, yep, it's obvious they have them. What can we learn from it? And learn from it in an objective way.
Well, a main character in your book, John, is the cat, Penguino. The annoying, I know, and I didn't start with him. That would have been tempting, but annoying, adorable. I mean, everything that a sort of curmudgeonly cat you'd expect to be. What's the bigger lesson in the end, you know, beyond the obvious that, oh, I thought I was a dog person. Penguino made me realize that I can tolerate cats. Beyond that, what has this absolutely funny, adorable cat taught you about animal personality, beyond the fact that, yeah, they have them?
Well, what he did is helped me to understand how much I didn't understand initially. So I can say I'm a dog person, I don't like cats, here's this obnoxious cat that gets, you know, plopped in my lap. And I got to understand how, even though we're very different individuals, I could see just by his strength of personality that he has one, right? And then it got to the next moment of realizing, boy, here's two personalities that get along. Here's two personalities of animals of very different species that get along, that bond. And because of this unique bond between us, we found a way to cooperate such that he does a little better when I'm around, and I do a little bit better when he's around. So it's a great eye-opening experience and a great learning experience. And actually, I got to give the guy a little credit for helping.
Well, and has Penguino made you more tolerant of obnoxious people?
Oh, I hope so. I bet. You know what? I hadn't even thought about that, but I bet he has. I definitely bet he has.
Well, John, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. That's John Shivick again. He's a wildlife biologist, author of the book we talked about, Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.